You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll look at, first, Britain's risotto crisis. Why is The Guardian panicking about the traditional Italian dish? Second, and finally, we'll turn to another listener question. How does the global market for fossil fuels actually work? Before we begin today's show, I just wanted to flag another Macrodose Live event that will be running next month in partnership with the think tank Autonomy. The event will be hosted by Dahlia Gabriel, former Macrodose guest host and lecturer at King's College London, who will be in conversation with the brilliant AJ Chowdhury about his new book, The Exhausted of the Earth. This was our book of the month last month, and I highly recommend it. AJ brings together both the science and the politics of climate change, showing catastrophe demands a bitter struggle between those attached to the power, wealth, and security of business as usual, and all of us, those exhausted in every sense of the word by the doom loop of the status quo. The event will be held on May the 15th at Pelican House in East London, and you can get your free ticket now using the link in the show notes of this episode. Time for our first story this week, Britain's risotto crisis. I want to begin today by picking up on a very Guardian headline this week that highlighted the disappearance of risotto rice from British supermarket shelves, and indeed everywhere else. In the piece, journalist Rachel Cook bewails the disappearance of the traditional Italian dish as arborio rice varieties, threatened by devastating repeated droughts in Italy's Po Valley, are vanishing from our cupboards. The Po suffered its worst drought in 200 years in 2022, and new varieties of rice, better adapted to these harsher conditions, just aren't suitable for making traditional risotto, which, as all of you chefs out there will know, requires a drawn-out cooking process and a slow absorption of the flavours. Now, on one level, as Rachel admits in her column, this is a wildly middle-class concern. But on another, it's yet another tangible way in which climate change is impacting our everyday lives. The piece rightly links this drop-off to a wider global picture, of which the changing patterns of consumption in Britain are only a small part. An expansion in the varieties of accessible food was no doubt a big upside of globalisation over the last three decades. Although to an extent, this has been slightly overdone. David Edgerton's The Rise and Fall of the British Nation notes that in the earlier 20th century, the full English breakfast would include Danish bacon, Dutch eggs and bread made from Canadian or Argentine wheat. And needless to say that running a vast and exploitative empire also had a considerable impact on Britain's national diet. If you're interested in some of these histories, I definitely recommend Lewis Bassett's excellent podcast, The Full English, which delves into the surprising history of Britain's food, including the eponymous breakfast. Anyway, the long and short of it is that Britain, over the last century or so, has historically been a nation which depends on food imports. We briefly approached self-sufficiency again, for the first time since World War II, in the 1980s, before the opening up of European markets after 1992, once again shifted the production of food and consumer preferences, including the consumption of risotto. I can't be sure when I first ate one, but without throwing any shade, I'm pretty confident Wigan in the late 1980s didn't typically run to risotto, and yet now here's The Guardian elsewhere calling it a midweek staple. Today, the whole country has an exceptional reliance on what the rest of the world supplies to us to keep us fed. Swati Dhingra, an economist on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, has warned that we depend on imports for 80% of our food, once you take into account things like the need for fertilisers. Britain now has just a single factory that can produce fertiliser, the other one having closed down 2 years ago. Our exposure to what happens to food supplies in the rest of the world is, for a developed economy, dramatically high. It's not just risotto rice disappearing, it's the fact that tomatoes, somehow available in Northern Europe in January, were no longer to be found on supermarket shelves last year, the result not so much of Brexit as a massive drought across the Mediterranean. Or as we covered a couple of weeks ago, it's the fact your Easter egg is getting much more expensive due to droughts hitting cocoa production in West Africa. Taking the global picture as a whole really does underline just how serious this is getting. After 25 years of solid progress in reducing world hunger, recent years have seen an alarming uptick. In 1990, just under 20% of the world population suffered from undernourishment, and this had fallen to 8% in 2015, only to rise again every year since then, and it's now at over 10%. It's true that COVID didn't help, but harvest yields have consistently fallen across the world even before the pandemic, and extreme weather events have become even more damaging. In the most dangerous cases, such as South Sudan and Yemen, famine has been wrapped up in war, with control of food supplies used as a weapon of conflict. Nowhere is this more evident than in the current horrific atrocities in Gaza, where 1.1 million people face starvation in the next few weeks. This is perhaps the most obvious, appalling example of how famine is sharpened into a weapon of mass destruction applied to a civilian population. Going back to rice, a staple for 4 billion people globally, forecasts suggest a 40% decline in harvest by the end of this century. 2023 saw a deficit in rice supplies relative to demand of 8.7 million tonnes globally, the worst for 20 years. And as yields have fallen, countries have reacted to protect their domestic populations. India, the world's largest rice exporter, has barred the export of non-basmati rice for the last year or so, and Vietnam has likewise imposed a ban. This may increase supplies domestically, but adds to the pressures being placed on the global system. One estimate is that the Indian export ban increased rice prices across Southeast Asia by 22%. There's a ripple effect that starts to spread out from actions like this. Other countries, like the Philippines and Myanmar, have introduced price ceilings on the cost of rice in an effort to protect households. As we've covered before, a decisive factor in those price rises is not only the actions of governments, but critically, the speculative and price-gouging activities increasingly of the major suppliers. Cooperation between countries isn't essential, though hard to come by, but so too is rinsing out the profiteering from the global system. So yes, it's possible to laugh at this Guardian headline, and some people did, but beneath the supposed middle-class hand-wringing lies a genuinely important story, and even a glimpse into our potential future. If we don't take these shortages seriously, and develop a strategy to cope with the real and predictable supply shocks of the future, it'll be more than risotto that disappears from our supermarket shelves. Our second story this week is a listener's question. This week's comes from Kenny, who has written to us on our email, macrodose@planetbproductions.co.uk, to ask, "Hi James, I am loving the podcast. Last week you indicated that one of the real reasons for the boom in America was the low price of energy caused by local production. My question is, how are American prices insulated from global prices? In the UK, one of the arguments against increasing oil production is that it will make little difference to domestic prices as it will be sold to a global market. Greater UK production will have little impact on UK prices. Why don't American producers sell on this market and make more profit? In other words, how does the low price of American fossil fuel influence the global price? Many thanks and keep up the good work, Kenny." So hi Kenny, thanks for listening and for raising an excellent question. As regular listeners of the show will know, the failure of mainstream economics to really comprehend the enormity of America's shale revolution is something of a bugbear of mine. Since 2019, the US has become a net exporter of fossil fuels, meaning it sells more abroad than it buys from the rest of the world. And as Kenny says, on last week's show, I mentioned that this had been a key factor in keeping US energy inflation lower than in Europe and the UK over recent years. So how does this mechanism actually work? Why don't US fossil fuel producers simply chase higher profits on the global market? It just so happens that there was a paper published this week by the Washington-based National Bureau for Economic Research on exactly this question, so I'll pick up on that as we go along. The starting point is that fossil fuel markets differ globally. Kenny's absolutely right to say that the price of crude oil is set internationally, with different prices depending on different grades of oil. Crude oil is graded by its density, how thick it is, which determines how easily it flows, and its sulfur content, with less sulfur being sweet and more sulfur being sour. These factors vary depending on where the oil has come from and matter because they determine how easily the oil can be refined into more valuable products like petrol or kerosene. Light, sweet oil, like the stuff that comes from the North Sea, called Brent crude, costs more because it's easier to refine. Urals oil from Russia is heavy and sour, and typically cheaper because it's harder to refine. Beyond that, because oil can generally be traded very easily using a vast global infrastructure, the different grades typically each have their own global price. So as Kenny says, when the suggestion was made by the government that Britain should be drilling oil from the North Sea to cut British prices, this was nonsense. The price of the oil pumped from beneath the grey waves is set globally. If you pump more, you can sell it at the global price. It doesn't somehow reduce the cost in the UK. Around 80% of the North Sea oil produced is actually exported anyway. The majority of oil we use to fuel our cars actually comes from the Middle East. The critical factor here, and the point where the really hefty profits can be made in oil production, should any listener fancy getting into it, is in refining. Once the oil is drilled, transported, and perhaps stored, it can be taken to the most economical refinery nearest the market where it will eventually be used. Differences here start to determine differences in national prices of oil, although the biggest single difference between different countries is what the government does to the price you might see at a petrol pump, how heavily oil is taxed, or in many cases, subsidised. So that's oil. It's a big global market for the raw liquid divided by type, with price differences for consumers in different countries very largely determined by what different governments do. Natural gas, on the other hand, doesn't really work like this. Physically, it's harder to store and transport, until fairly recently needing a system of pipelines and gasometers, meaning that, again until pretty recently, there was no true global market for it. Instead, the world divided roughly into two spheres, the Eurasian gas system, supplied by gas fields right across from the North Sea through the Urals to Siberia, and the American system, with gas fields in North and South America supplying their respective continents. There was no transatlantic pipeline linking the two. The systems remained fundamentally distinct markets, which meant in practice the prices of the two could diverge fairly significantly. This has been disrupted by two technological breakthroughs in the last few decades or so. The first is the production of liquefied natural gas, LNG, which allows gas to be turned into a liquid, and so transported further without the need for pipelines. The technique of liquefying the gas so it can be stored and transported in somewhat more convenient form has been known since the early 20th century, but it's only in the last few decades that it's become really economically viable. As you can imagine, it's quite difficult and expensive to cool natural gas down to about minus 270 degrees, store it safely, send it across the world, and then reverse the process at the other end. But nonetheless, it's now viable. Volumes transported globally have not far off doubled since 2012, with the disruption from Russia's invasion of Ukraine giving a massive boost to the industry in the rest of the world. The second technological breakthrough is hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which is a technique of blasting loose underground shale with water to extract the oil or gas mixed in with it. It's not really viable for built-up areas, as all the reports of minor earthquakes, gas coming out of domestic water taps and so on suggest. But in the great expanses of the United States, it's been a massive boost to production, allowing far more gas and oil to be produced at a viable cost. The result of the fracking boom in the US is that fossil fuel production has steadily increased, hitting an all-time high in the last year. Put all this together, and what we're starting to see is the emergence of a global market for gas as fracked natural gas from the US is liquefied, turned into LNG, and sold around the world. Until fairly recently, the US's capacity to export the LNG was pretty restricted. There weren't enough terminals to get the gas out, and so it was consumed domestically, with the US hugely expanding its fleet of gas-fired power plants. For the first time ever, a majority of US electricity was produced from natural gas last summer. This expanded domestic production has helped keep US costs down. But as liquefied natural gas export capacity has grown, suppliers have been keen to get more of the stuff sold in higher-priced Eurasian markets. And that, in turn, has meant pressure on US domestic prices as they start to move in line with the prices in the rest of the world. The National Bureau paper reckons that the change in the cost to US consumers over the last 2 years has been equivalent to a $30 a ton carbon tax. In other words, a fairly substantial new cost for US consumers. I mentioned last week that the Biden administration was looking to bar further expansion of liquefied natural gas export terminals in the US. Long term, we can speculate that this reflects a strategic need to build up domestic energy supplies. But in the short term, in this election year, it's a mechanism to restrict US supplies reaching the rest of the world, reducing the US market's connection to it, and so keeping, potentially, domestic prices lower than they would otherwise have been. So I hope that answers the question, which I thought was a great one. It gets right to the centre of the interconnected issues of climate change, the end or not of globalisation, and the impacts on people's living standards. Thanks, Kenny. And do keep your questions coming in on our email, Patreon, or social channels. As always, you can find the relevant links in the show notes at the end of this episode. One final plug this week. I'll be speaking at the Think Global, Act Local conference this Saturday, the 23rd of March, at Birkbeck College, London, alongside Professor Mary Koldor on What Comes After Neoliberalism. There's a great lineup of other speakers and sessions, so check out their website for the whole timetable. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.